Good evening, everyone, and welcome to event 47 of the 2015 Ledbury Poetry Festival. I'd also like to thank Arts Council England, who are the festival sponsors, and especially Orme & Slade, who are the sponsors for this evening. And what a great event we have lined up. This is going to be something very special. So can I ask you to give a big welcome, please, to Mark Fisher and Michael Palin.
Thank you, Brenda. It's a cliche for somebody introducing something like this to say, "My guest does needs no introduction," but it actually is true. I mean, in this case, it's hard to find anything that you don't know, perhaps from Wikipedia, but mainly from watching the telly and the series and. Have you seen the range of books and where Michael has been? And that's merely a slither of there, and his wonderful diaries. But we'll come to those at the end when it's book signing time. But you know all about him. But what you might not all of you will be quite as familiar with, is a side of his life that I think is quite exceptional. I love his film, his art films. He's done a series of wonderful films that, amazingly, the BBC have not turned into a full-blown series, coherent series. He's done a wonderful film on Hammershoy, a fantastic film on Andrew Wyeth, on Anne Redpath, a beautiful Scottish painter, and the Scottish colourists. They really are exceptional. You think you know him through Monty Python and through his travellings, but these films, you can get them. Can you get them on
playback? There is a BBC did produce a DVD called Palin on Art.
Quite right, too.
Which I think is now been remaindered. no, seriously, they only printed a certain number, and it sold quite well, so they didn't print any more.
But they
you might find it on eBay. Or
Palin on Art. They'll get repeated, and they really are good. And that's how I first met Michael at the Royal Academy when he came to speak. Very well indeed. And I didn't know about them at that point, and they are wonderful films. So, but that's a little slither in addition to tonight.
Thank you.
Michael, where are we going to start? I think with Walter Raleigh.
But yes.
How did you come across him? I mean, was he at school?
I knew about Walter Raleigh. He's one of the first English heroes one knows about. But I didn't realise until later on that Walter Raleigh was also a quite prolific poet, as they all seemed to be then. You know, they were courtiers, adventurers, slave traders, but also quite good poets. And Walter Raleigh's poem, which I think a lot of people know, is "All the World's a Stage." And I just remember hearing this quite early on. And it was one of the first bits of serious poetry I knew. But and so I thought, well, begin at the beginning. It's perhaps the best one to do.
Was it was he in prison when he wrote this?
I don't know where he was, actually, at the time. No, I don't know the background. Anyway, Walter Raleigh, "All the World's a Stage." What is our life? A play of passion. Our mirth, the music of division. Our mother's wombs, the towering houses be, where we are dressed for this short comedy. Heaven, the judicious, sharp spectator is, that sits and marks still who doth act amiss. Our graves that hide us from the searching sun are like drawn curtains when the play is done. Thus march we playing to our latest rest. Only we die in earnest. That's no jest. I just rather like the idea of seeing life as, what does he call it? A short comedy. And it's a rather neat little metaphor for how we go through our life, and suitable to one whose only talent is a bit of acting. You know, I feel it's saying something to me.
A bit of acting, yes, yes. Now, your next one, and that was, did you come across that originally at school?
Right? Yes, yeah. I mean, I had a very good grounding in poetry at school. Had some very enlightened teachers. And I think that the problem with me with poetry, I mean, I learnt the poetic form from very early on. I mean, just songs, chants, the things you sort of chant in the playground. They're also all poetry. The songs you listen to, you know, every day, you're getting a little closer, you know, the whatever, it's Buddy Holly or Elvis, it's all poetry. And when we got to school, it became slightly more serious, and I think sometimes it can fall into, become slightly pretentious. But I did learn that poetry can be quite exact and quite quite complex. Mm-hmm. And this next one, which is Mending Wall by Robert Frost, it's a difficult poem for a 15-year-old, but I got to know it because I was put in by my English teacher for the Bentley Elocution Prize. We had to stand on stage and elocute. And this was, we got through the various rounds. I think one of them was a poem by Crabb about Alborough and all that. But Mending Wall was the final one we had to do, and I remember reading it with knees shaking. And it's quite a complicated poem. I didn't read it, actually, then. I knew it, but I'm afraid now I'd have to read it. Okay, so this is Mending Wall by Robert Frost. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbour know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He's all pine and I'm apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbours. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbours? Isn't it where there are cows, but here there are no cows? Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offence. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbours.
I'm so glad you chose that, because I absolutely love it, and it means a lot to me. In the 70s, I went up to North Staffordshire, where I eventually got into Stoke-on-Trent, and I had a small holding in the 70s. Everybody was into self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
And though this is beautiful country around here, it's not stone walls here. But North Staffs is. And so I spent a lot of time trying to learn to make dry stone walls. Never very good at it.
But it was actually in round Sheffield.
Dry stone walls. Which is your home.
It's my home. In fact, I have a rather sad story about a dry stone wall. The day after I passed my driving test, I borrowed a car that was a works car from my father's works and was riding back, having dropped a girlfriend who I hoped I'd impressed back at her house, and drove along the top Ringlow Road, and it was quite wet. And I suddenly realised our term's coming up. And, of course, I didn't know enough then not to brake very hard. And I braked very hard. The car spun around three times and went backwards through a dry stone wall. So there was a neat hole of fitting a Hillman Minx through a dry stone wall. I mean, I was absolutely terrified. I'm sorry, I haven't admitted that to any audience anywhere. So Mark wheedled that out of me with his talk of dry stone walls. But
someone else, I don't know whether you like her poetry, I love it, who writes very well about dry stone walls, is Alice Oswald,
I don't know enough. I must go and...
Go and look. She's really good.
This is part of my education today.
Next one means a lot to me too, Westminster Bridge.
Yes. William Wordsworth upon Westminster Bridge. I really chose this, I suppose, because for 50 years, although I was born and brought up in Sheffield, I lived in London. And occasionally London can look very beautiful, and I can almost identify, with the poem he's written here. It's called Upon Westminster Bridge, September the 3rd, 1802. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth, like a garment, wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Ships, towers, domes, theatres and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendour valley, rock or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
It's still a great view, isn't it?
It is a great view.
Though an even better one, my view, is from Waterloo Bridge.
Waterloo, I think, is...
When you can see...
Yes,
some
you get more of the curve. But I think there is a moment... I've experienced that moment when you have to get up early and it's a lovely sunny morning and you're up about 6 or 7 o'clock and London can look as beautiful as... I mean, Wordsworth, you know, is a kind of rural poet of the countryside, but you can understand how he can compare a busy city with the country.
I was very lucky when I was an MP that the last 10 years I had an office at the top of Portcullis House, which was just pitched over Westminster Bridge.
Yeah.
And so I looked down on the river and every day, and it was wonderful.
Worth going into politics, do you think not?
Well, not quite.
On.
You're next.
My next is a war poet, and I very much... I was very moved by the war poets. I mean, this was while I was at school at Shrewsbury. I think I first was introduced to them. And first of all, I think through, not poetry, but through Robert Graves's book, Goodbye to All That, the experiences that people had had and the awfulness which they tried to translate into words. And Wilfred Owen became a poet I was particularly moved by. In fact, actually, I've seen his grave since then. We did a programme about the last day of World War I and I saw where he was buried. And, of course, he died just about a week before the end of the war. And his parents didn't know until the bells were pealing over Shrewsbury for peace when a telegram came through the door and said that your son died 7 or 8 days ago. So a young man, but very mature in his poetry. And I've chosen one called Spring Offensive, which is not one that people often... Here, but here it goes. Spring Offensive by Wilfred Owen. Halted against the shade of a last hill, they fed, and lying easy were at ease, and finding comfortable chests and knees, carelessly slept. But many there stood still to face the stark, blank sky beyond the ridge, knowing their feet had come to the end of the world. Marvelling they stood and watched the long grass swirled by the May breeze, murmurous with wasp and midge. For though the summer oozed into their veins like an injected drug for their body's pains, sharp on their souls hung the imminent line of grass. Fearfully flashed the sky's mysterious glass. Hour after hour they ponder the warm field and the far valley behind, where the buttercup had blessed with gold their slow boots coming up, where even the little brambles would not yield, but clutched and clung to them like sorrowing hands. They breathed like trees unstirred. Till like a cold gust thrills the little word, at which each body and its soul be gird and tighten them for battle. No alarms of bugles, no high flags, no clamorous haste, only a lift and flare of eyes that faced the sun, like a friend with whom their love is done. O larger shone that smile against the sun, mightier than his whose bounty these have spurned. So soon they topped the hill and raced together over an open stretch of herb and heather, exposed. And instantly the whole sky burned with fury against them. Earth set sudden cups in thousands for their blood, and the green slope chasmed and steepened sheer to infinite space. Of them who, running on that last high place, leapt to swift unseen bullets, or went up on the hot blast and fury of hell's upsurge, or plunged and fell away past this world's verge. Some say God caught them even before they fell. But what say such as from existence brink ventured, but drave too swift to sink, the few who rushed in the body to enter hell, and there outfiending all its fiends and flames with superhuman unhumanities, long famous glories, immemorial shames, and crawling slowly back have by degrees regained cool, peaceful air in wonder. Why speak not they of comrades that went under? Powerful stuff.
One of the joys of doing of these sessions is to be introduced to a poem that you didn't know. And I thought I knew D.H. Lawrence pretty well. But
Wilfred Owen.
Sorry.
Michael. You're not in charge. He's in charge.
We're moving on.
We're moving on. That's very good. Excuse me.
Now, I did know Spring Offensive. Yeah. Wonderful it is. But D.H. Lawrence, I thought I knew quite well. That lovely piano. Do you know Piano Sitting Under
Yes,
the Piano?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Undervalued poet, I think. Yes.
But I didn't know this next one, so I'm very grateful to you to bring this Lawrence to my attention. Thank you.
Well, I felt it could be almost written about me because I am troubled and accused always with the N word. And so this is the ultimate poem about the N word.
It's true.
Don't you start. D.H. Lawrence, and it's called The English Are So Nice. The English are so nice. So awfully nice. They're the nicest people in the world. What's more, they're very nice about being nice. About your being nice as well. If you're not nice, they soon make you feel it. Americans and French and Germans and so on, they're all very well, but they're not really nice, you know? Not nice in our sense of the word, are they now? That's why one doesn't have to take them seriously. We must be nice to them, of course. Yeah, of course, naturally. But it doesn't really matter what you say to them. They don't really understand. You can just say anything to them. Be nice, you know, just nice. But you must never take them seriously. They wouldn't understand. Just be nice, you know? Fairly nice, not too nice, of course. They take advantage, but nice enough, just nice enough to let them feel they're not quite as nice as they might be.
You can see where the parrot sketch comes from.
I have to thank Ben Kingsley for that, because I contributed to a book of poems for refugees to get some raise funds for Refugee Council, and that was the one he chose. Yes. So good.
Yeah. Yes, lovely, but very nice.
Survey.
And you don't think of Lawrence again as a humorist, but that's
no, absolutely not at all.
Poem.
Yeah, that's one.
So, moving on. How did that come into your life, by the way?
The D.H. Lawrence?
Yeah.
Well, as
Ben Kingsley.
Yeah, Ben Kingsley. I've read quite a lot of Lawrence. I haven't read that, like you. So, yeah. I mean, I think it must have been just seeing it in that collection.
Well, that makes you feel better.
The title caught my eye, and being nice, I thought, well, this will be... I'll sort this out.
Swapping poems with friends and is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Learn from each other.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You learn much more later in life than you do at school, I find.
Yes, I think good. School you're slightly forced to, and you're also slightly programmed in later life. You can choose what you want.
Anyway, but The next one.
The next one is W.H. Auden, who is one of my favourite poets. Moved me more than most, really. This is one which I particularly like because we talked about art and our love of painting and all that. And this is just a beautiful poem about observing and what you see in paintings and what you don't see, and little bits on the side. So it's by Auden, and it's called Musée des Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who didn't specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of a wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course, anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life, and the torturous horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away, quite leisurely, from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to, on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
Beautifully read. But it's surprising how few really good poems about paintings there are, don't you think?
Yes, yes.
Sublime, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's what I sort of feel very much when I look at paintings. I love to roam around and spend time and see what's happening on the periphery, and especially with Bruegel's and things like that. There's so much going on. And I think we don't look closely at paintings. I don't look closely enough. We tend to look at them and go on to the next one. I can spend 5 or 10 minutes looking at one painting.
It is extraordinary in a gallery, isn't it? When you look at other people and they walk straight past.
Yes.
They glance.
Yeah.
And they don't get into a painting at all.
Or they take a selfie, so they look at the painting next time round. It's a wonderful Auden's bit of observation.
Wonderful.
Beautifully done. And he could also write, you know, the poems about September 1939. Terrific and very, very sort of strong and intense poems. That's rather playful.
Now, your next two is a poet I'm ashamed to say I'd never heard of before.
Yes.
So I'm again grateful to you for introducing me.
Well, I think you'll enjoy...
Tell us something about...
I think you'll enjoy
this. Who knows Harry Graham?
Graham. I don't know Harry Graham. Harry Jocelyn Clive Graham, 1874 to 1936. And he's a rather dapper man, a little moustache and a little hat and all that. And he wrote these rather sort of wonderfully black comic poems. And I was introduced to them by my wife's father, who thought they were absolutely wonderful. And he had a pretty warped sense of humour. But anyway, I'll give you a little flavour. This is just a short one to start with, and then a slightly longer one afterwards. When skiing in the Engadine, my hat blew off down a ravine. My son, who went to fetch it back, slipped through an icy glacier's crack and then got permanently stuck. Really was infernal luck. My hat was practically new. I love my little Henry too, and I may have to wait for years till either of them reappears. So this is a slightly longer one, because this I like not just because it's his style, but also I think it's just as true now as it was then. This must have been in the 1920s. It's called Luncheon. To entertain one's friends at lunch, singly or in a solid bunch, this is indeed a daily joy, a pastime that can never cloy. The restaurant that you select, if you would win the world's respect, must be some centre of renown, the most expensive place in town, where guests in admiration lost delight to think how much they cost. And he is deemed the nicest host who manages to spend the most. My brother Fritz, one summer's day, was lunching with his fiancée, but must, I think, have lost his wits. For when he got her to the Ritz, he ordered Irish stew for two, a thing no gentleman would do. And then instead of quails or snipe, a mayonnaise of tepid tripe, and finish up this ghastly meal with vol-au-vent of jellied eel. You can imagine what ensued, with what disgust poor Mabel viewed the offal heaped upon her plate, and how her love was turned to hate. The love light faded from her eyes, as sunshine pales in wintry skies. The tears she was too proud to wipe went trickling down into the tripe. The scorn she could not conceal was mirrored in each jellied eel. Passion lay dead, romance took wing. She gave her lover back his ring. Today, with Mabel at the Ritz, some more fastidious lover sits. While at some restaurant unknown, Fritz eats pig's trotters all alone. She's very good. Just very quick, this is the bottom of the page here. I had written to Aunt Maud, who was on a trip abroad, when I heard she died of cramp. Just too late to save the stamp.
What you couldn't see is the illustrations of that, and they're very nice,
oh, yes,
aren't they?
Yes,
and
yes, yeah.
It put me in mind that Belloc, who I think is also very funny,
yes,
his, the Bentley illustrations in Belloc are,
yes,
are
I don't
wonderful.
Know who did
these.
It doesn't say who did these, but this is a wonderful
but they look
collection.
They're very nice. They're a different period than Belloc, obviously.
Yes, but, yes.
But
later.
They're very
yeah.
elegant.
Yeah. Yes, very good.
So we must all go and find Harry Graham.
Harry Graham, yes, when it's Grandma fell off the
it's
boat.
It's very, very nice to know, because wonderful though this festival is, we're always looking for humorous poems.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I didn't know Harry Graham. So, yeah. Yeah. Chloe, what do you think? Harry Graham possibly is a small event next year or year after?
Harry Graham season. probably
yes. Ogden Nash, nice. Mm.
Yes, yeah, yes, no. That, I mean, good satire, too. I mean, yeah. It's very, very true about the most expensive restaurant in Preston.
It is very nice. Now, back to the more serious stuff with Cavafy.
Yes. Cavafy, who I was quite liked. And this is, I think he's Egyptian, isn't he? Yeah. Cavafy, yes. And this is called Waiting for the Barbarians. It's a rather remarkable poem. I like it. I like what it's about. I like what it's saying. Let's read it anyway, and then we can see whether you feel the same. It's called Waiting for the Barbarians by C.P. Cavafy. What are we waiting for, assembled in the forum? The barbarians are due here today. Why isn't anything going on in the Senate? Why are the senators sitting there without legislating? Because the barbarians are coming today. What's the point of senators making laws now? Once the barbarians are here, they'll do the legislating. Why did our emperor get up so early? And why is he sitting enthroned at the city's main gate, in state, wearing the crown? Because the barbarians are coming today, and the emperor's waiting to receive their leader. He's even got a scroll to give him, loaded with titles and imposing names. Why have our two consuls and praetors come out today wearing their embroidered, their scarlet togas? Why have they put on bracelets with so many amethysts, rings sparkling with magnificent emeralds? Why are they carrying elegant canes, beautifully worked in silver and gold? Because the barbarians are coming today, and things like that dazzle the barbarians. Why don't our distinguished orators turn up as usual to make their speeches, say what they have to say? Because the barbarians are coming today, and they're bored by rhetoric and public speaking. Why this sudden bewilderment, this confusion? How serious people's faces have become. Why are the streets and squares emptying so rapidly, everyone going home, lost in thought? Because night has fallen, and the barbarians haven't come. And some of our men just in from the border say there are no barbarians any longer. Now, what's going to happen to us without barbarians? Those people were a kind of solution. We all know what that's about, the enemy.
I don't know this book. I mean,
This was another Poems for Refugees. Yeah, yeah, yes. Very good. It's available now. It's for War Child. A very lovely collection of poems. And that's that was from John Fortune, who really? I used to know and work with. Oh. Sadly died recently, but it's
real
left
loss.
A good taste behind.
Yeah. What a loss.
Yeah.
now, something a little later.
Yes. This is Philip Larkin. Again, I like very much. I think for anyone born in the, you know, around about the sort of end of the war and growing up in the 50s and 60s, Philip Larkin was a kind of emblematic of what was sort of kind of going on in one's mind. And he was just saying things that, you know, people never, ever, ever dared say in poetry. And this is not something that I would ever have been taught at school. But, of course, now he's just been being entombed in Westminster Abbey. But this is one of his, which you, I'm sure many of you know, This Be the Verse, it's called. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Little spirit of Harry Graham there, but absolutely, slightly more serious.
But you and I both like Adrian Mitchell very much. And
yes.
He wrote a lovely riposte of that.
Oh, right.
Can I read it?
Yes, please do. Yes, absolutely.
It's called They Tuck You Up. They tuck you up, your mum and dad. They read you Peter Rabbit, too. They give you all the treats they had and add some extra just for you. They were tucked up when they were small. Pink perfume, blue tobacco smoke, by those whose kiss healed any fall, whose laughter doubled any joke. Man hands on happiness to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. So love your parents all you can, and have some cheerful kids yourself.
It needed that, really, didn't it?
It did. He was a lovely man, wasn't he?
And yes. No. Absolutely. Great.
And his widow, Celia, is, I think, a friend of both of us.
Yes, his widow, Celia, started a shop called Ripping Yarns, which he got Terry Jones and myself to open.
Oh.
And it's still there up in Highgate, selling books and of that sort of period and all sorts of lovely things.
It is just possible that we will have an Adrian Mitchell event in a future year, for Chloe wills it, and if we did, it would be very nice if you came back and played Mitchell.
I'd try and do that. Yes, I mean, so many people love his work, and there's all the Liverpool poets, Roger McGough, and people like that who love
absolutely
his stuff.
I think
would read
a good event.
They would read with great sort of enthusiasm.
In the 70s, I ran an education centre in Cheshire called Tattenhall, and Adrian Henry was the poet paid for by the Arts Council in residence. And so all that generation, Adrian Mitchell and Roger McGough and Norman McCaig, and they all came and read an awful lot at my centre, which is a fantastic privilege.
Yeah.
I think it would make a nice bench, don't you?
That's very good, yes, yeah.
Chloe,
he's trying to sign me up on the dotted line, but certainly if I'm here.
Wonderful director of this festival, and it's nothing like bouncing her in public into an event for the future, but I don't think she needs a lot of bouncing in this instance. Now, back to more serious stuff, your next choice.
My next choice is Clive James. Sentenced to Life. I know Clive, I've known him quite a long time, been on his show and all that, and he really is a marvellous poet, and somehow the awful thing that's happened to him, really, and his very, very serious illness has brought some wonderful work out of him. And I'm going to use the title poem of this collection, which is called Sentenced to Life. Sentenced to life, I sleep face up as though ice-bound, lest I should cough the night away. When I walk the mile to town, I show the right technique for wading through deep clay. A sad man, sorrier than he can say. But surely not so guilty he should die each day from knowing that his race is run. My sin was to be faithless. I would lie as if I could be true to everyone at once and all the damage that was done was in the name of love, or so I thought. I might have met my death believing this, but no, there was a lesson to be taught. Now, not just old, but ill with much amiss, I see things with a whole new emphasis. My daughter's garden has a goldfish pool with six fish, each a little finger long. I stand and watch them, following their rule of never touching, never going wrong, trajectories as perfect as plain song. Once I would not have noticed, nor have known the name for Japanese anemones, so pale, so frail. But now I catch the tone of leaves. No birds can touch down in the trees without my seeing them. I count the bees. Even my memories are clearly seen. Whence comes the answer if I'm told I must be aching for my homeland? Had I been dulled in the brain to match my lungs of dust, there'd be no recollection I could trust. Yet I, despite my guilt, despite my grief, watch the Pacific sunset, heaven sent, in glowing colours and in sharp relief, painting the white clouds when the day is spent, as if it were my will and testament. As if my first impressions were my last, and time had only made them more defined, now I'm weak. The sky is overcast here in the English autumn, but my mind basks in the light I never left behind.
If you haven't seen this book yet, it came out earlier in the year, didn't it?
Yes, I think
and
so.
And it's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
We've tried to get him to come down to the festival, but sadly he's not well enough. Mm. But it was so nice to have him read. Thank you. Thank you, Michael, very much indeed. He and I, we were Cambridge together. He is, I'm glad to say, slightly older than me. He was a postgraduate and I was an undergraduate. We were both in love with the same girl, and neither of us were very successful with her. Wonderful, beautiful girl called Jan Parry. Do you remember her?
Jan Parry.
Yeah.
She was the ballet critic
for the Observer.
God, yeah. I was talking to her on Sunday. Seriously. And she was very nice to me. No, I happened to see her at her.
She was beautiful.
Friend's party, yeah.
But both Clive and I loved her.
Ooh.
Right.
Moment of hanky needed. Yes, yeah.
More laughs, I think.
Well, yes. I've just chosen this last one. I wasn't going to read any Spike Milligan, but you, when we had our lunch together, said, what about Spike? He's a wonderful poet. And of course he is. And he's kind of, again, rather underrated because you think they're just silly poems. But he had a wonderful way of, where he writes. He writes very well. It's very good to read. I mean, I used to read my children the wonderful story, Bad Jelly the Witch, and things like that. They absolutely loved it, mainly because one of the characters' trousers fell down at a certain point. They just thought this was marvellous, but he just puts it in, weaves it in well. So I thought I should, because he was also a friend and a great inspiration, Spike, for me in my working life. So I thought I would end my selection with Spike's rather lovely poem called Have a Nice Day. Help, help, said a man, I'm drowning. Hang on, said a man from the shore. Help, help, said the man, I'm not clowning. Yes, I know, I heard you before. Be patient, dear man who is drowning. You see, I've got a disease. I'm waiting for a Dr. J. Browning, so do be patient, please. How long, said the man who was drowning, will it take for the doc to arrive? Not very long, said the man with the disease. Till then, try staying alive. Very well, said the man who was drowning. I'll try and stay afloat by reciting the poems of Browning and other things he wrote. Help, help, said the man with the disease. I suddenly feel quite ill. Keep calm, said the man who was drowning. Breathe deeply and lie quite still. Oh, dear, said the man with the awful disease. I think I'm going to die. Farewell, said the man who was drowning. Said the man with the disease, goodbye. So the man who was drowning drowned, and the man with the disease passed away. But apart from that and a fire in my flat, it's been a very nice day.
It's a beauty. The one I love is, there are holes in the sky where the rain gets in, but they're ever so small, that's why rain's so thin.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that Milligan and the goons are very much the parents of Python. Do you not feel? Was that conscious or not?
It was something we all absorbed, and not sure all of us. Certainly John, myself and Terry Gilliam wouldn't have known the goons, really, but we absorbed a lot of the goons. That was our sort of liberating comedy at the time, the sort of comedy that our parents didn't understand at all. Grown men with silly voices going, I used to listen to it at home and just hope and pray that my father wouldn't come into the room when it was on. And he did, you know, during one of those, oh, let me know, what are you doing now? He said, something wrong with the set, old boy. And I said, oh, it's comedy. And so, you know, we Spike did a TV show called Q5 just before Python.
Yeah.
Which had a lot of very silly things in, which inspired us in many ways, and we also poached his director. We thought anyone who can direct Spike is the right person to be directing Python.
Really?
Yes, Ian McNaughton. He was very important to us because he kind of thought of comedy slightly outside the box. No one was writing quite like he did. And he was fairly fearless and had his crusades to say this and say that. He was a very sort of passionate man.
Oh, and very good on war, too, wasn't he?
Yes.
He really was angry about violence and war.
Yeah.
Good man.
Yeah.
You aren't going to have many opportunities to ask Michael questions. And we haven't, unfortunately... A mistake of mine in setting this up, and I take entire responsibility, but not the wonderful direction of this festival. But we haven't got a mic, so if you want to ask a question or two, is that all right, Michael?
Of course, yes, absolutely.
And to ask a question, if you say it loudly, I will say it again so that everybody can hear, and we'll get it away like that. So anybody would like to ask Michael a question or make a point?
Or sit on the microphone. That's always a good idea.
The roof clearly is a microphone. Light.
If you're not careful.
No, you've... Oh, hello. Yes. You, sir.
Probably guess from my age, I grew up with Python, but also Python got me into poetry. That's it. There's a lot of poetry in Python. Have you said that to you before?
No.
Is there a lot of poetry in Python? Has Michael been asked that question before? This gentleman was brought up with Python and writes poetry and influenced by Python. So
was it the other way around? yes, I mean, there were little moments of poetry in Python, especially in the books we wrote and all that. Were little, I can't remember an awful lot at the moment. But that's a good point. Yes, I'm sorry I can't actually put chapter and verse to them right now, but we always thought that Python had a sort of poetic streak to it. I mean, even if it's just sort of the Knights of St. Nee, there's something about language and about how people speak and all that. Bold, Bold Sir Robin, that was a wonderful poem, a song by Eric Idle, you know. I wouldn't quote it. What? Yes, One About the Universe.
The One About the Universe, exactly. which has been the interjection.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, indeed, I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night. The Horace poem from the book, yeah, there we are. Yeah. Yes. So, there we go. There's a few.
Another question. We've probably got just time. You silence them, Michael. It's not very
Have
often.
I written that? I can read them. I've got a book here of my limericks.
Shall
I read them a limerick? Would you like a limerick?
For an encore.
Or some more Harry Graham?
A
Both.
Limerick as an encore.
Okay, I can see this is not a serious audience in any shape or form. Oh, dear, I don't know. I mean, this was a little book
These
called Limericks
are your
I did.
Limericks, are they?
Yes. I was asked by a publisher called, I can't remember their name now, Red Foxes, if I would like to write a book of limericks. And I said, oh, yes, I love limericks. And I said, how many would you need for the book? He said, we need about 190. So I started off. By the time I'd written about 10, I thought, this is it. This is the limit of the limerick form. But somehow I managed to write enough to fill this book. They're just very silly, really. No particular order. A Wrexham tattooist called Ken used to draw little pictures on men, sometimes a still life or another man's wife, or once in a while, Tony Benn. Curious fellow called Lamb used to shout things at old tins of Spam, like, you silly old tin, and where have you been? Then he'd move on and rubbish the jam. A handsome young German called Fritz, on seeing a friend do the splits, with a triumphant cry shouted, here, let me try, and broke into two equal bits. When asked tricky questions, old Riley would simply reply very dryly, sorry, old bean, don't know what you mean. Then sidle off home, smiling Riley. Smiling Riley. That's this sort of thing, you see. Yeah. Okay, so another Harry Graham, yes, by popular request. Okay. I haven't read all of them, so I don't really know, but let's see what we've got. When Grandmama fell off the boat and couldn't swim and wouldn't float, Matilda just stood by and smiled. I almost could have slapped the child.
He is very Hilaire Belloc, isn't he?
He is, yes, it is. It is. And rather, there's a German one here, I don't know what that is. During the German Emperor's recent visit to Brussels, Baron de Holleville, director of the Congo Museum, was presented to His Majesty. Well, I won't go into that. I think it's probably rather racist. I shall never forget my shame to find my son had forged my name. If he had any thoughts for others, he might at least have forged his mother's. How fond I was of Uncle Dan. Not since creation first began was there a more good-natured man, more kindly or indulgent. His ample face, he weighed a ton on everything and everyone, shone like some vast, benignant sun, as warm and as effulgent, a simple soul, devoid of guile. His life was one unending smile. He never lost his self-control at golf and at the 18th hole. His putt was bunkered by a mole, or he was laid a stymie. He never got the least annoyed when children, semi-anthropoid, his priceless ornaments destroyed, or made his shirt front grimy. At bridge, he took it as a joke if partners happened to revoke. I still remember how he smiled when Gwendolyn, his only child, was by a foreigner beguiled and afterwards deserted. And when his youngest nephew, Phil, who forged a name upon a bill, presented it with cunning skill and into cash converted, a smile my uncle's face o'erspread. Boys will be boys, was all he said. When his wife eloped one day because she could no longer stay with one who never would display the slightest sign of temper, more wide my uncle's grins became, he uttered not a word of blame. His motto still remained the same, still smiling, ridens semper.
A nice man.
Yes, a nice, oh dear, yes, there we go again.
Anyway, Michael, that was wonderful. Thank you very much indeed. Harry Graham, in case you didn't make a note of it, because I doubt that, I hope that I'm not the only person who was unaware of him before. So thank you very much indeed.
Great pleasure, thank you.
And we won't use the N-word, but it's true.
Well, thank you.